Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Barry Prezant. He is one of the world's leading authorities on autism. Dr. Prezant and I will be discussing inspiring stories and practical advice from his groundbreaking book on autism, Uniquely Human, A Different Way of Seeing Autism. The book is currently ranked number one in the developmental psychology category of the medical books section on Amazon.com. Good morning, Dr. Prezant. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning, sir?
I'm doing very good, and thank you for having me, Johnny.
Fantastic. It's great to have you on the air with me. Uniquely Human is a terrific read. It gave me a thorough inside look to the world of people on the spectrum. But most importantly, it gave me an appreciation for their uniqueness as human beings. So you did a fantastic job. It is a must-read for everyone. Congratulations, sir.
Great. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Yes, let's see if I can encapsulate that. I always like to point out that I'm a city kid. I grew up in New York City, pretty much on the streets of Brooklyn, playing stickball in the schoolyards, and really didn't go away, leave the city until I was 17 or 18 years of age. My first experience out of the city, actually, in terms of intensive experience, was working in a summer camp for people with disabilities, which included people with autism, but I didn't know the word at that time. I kind of had two parallel tracks in my life. One was working in these residential summer camps where I was a surrogate parent and caregiver for 2 months, and I did that for about 6 years, and then I kind of configured my college education in that direction. I was very interested in language and communication development, and then, of course, with the people I was working with and supporting, I was very interested in those people who had problems communicating and learning how to speak. So I ended up going into speech and language pathology, and very early in my career, I got focused on autism spectrum disorders as one of my areas of expertise. And in the 1970s, and some people refer to that as the dark ages of autism, but I disagree. There were some very nice things going on at that time with good teachers and parents really opening the envelope, if you will, for better services. But I did focus in the 70s in my master's thesis and doctoral dissertation on autism. And then since that time, I've worn a lot of hats. I've worked in Brown University Medical School. I've worked in two university graduate programs focusing on autism. And then over the last 18 years, I've been in private practice where I consult to schools. And I do trainings on an educational model that has to do with supporting children who have problems in communicating. One other thing I should say, actually a couple more things I should say, great influence on my life and my career, is that we've been doing a parent weekend retreat for 20 years. We raise money, and we go with 60 parents to this beautiful retreat center 1 weekend a year. And it's a great learning opportunity for me in terms of what the parent experience is and what the family experience is. And I should say the other great influence on my life is my wife of 28 years, Dr. Elaine Meyer, who works in the Harvard Medical School, and she's a psychologist and nurse. And she works on a program in which critical care physicians are taught and supported in how to work with families and communicate with families much better. So I feel just in summary, it's very difficult to separate my work from my life. And that's been a very, very important part for me, both in my family and all the relationships I have with families and with autistic children and people with autism.
Fantastic. Looks like you have a long line of professional connection with people of the spectrum. So let's talk about what is autism.
Well, autism is a developmental disability, and that's very important to highlight that point, because for many years ago, it was thought of as a behavior disorder, and it is not a behavior disorder. It is a disability that impacts development in certain areas. Now, what are those areas? First of all, communication, and that could range from not being able to learn to speak all the way to having very sophisticated language skills, but having problems carrying on conversations in what's referred to as reciprocal conversations, where a person, for example, may focus on what they're interested in, but having problems talking about what other people are interested in. Also, it's a disability of social understanding. We, who are not on the spectrum, engage so naturally and so, in some cases, effortlessly in interacting with other people through nonverbal behavior, through our conversational skills. We are very focused on other people, and we look at other people's behavior to guide us. So I always like to give the example of going into a cafeteria for the first time, a cafeteria you've never been in, because the very first thing we do is we observe other people, because different cafeterias, whether it's in a school or whether it's a restaurant cafeteria, they have different rules for how you get the food, how you get the utensils, when do you pay. We very naturally watch other people and kind of determine what the rules are for how we behave. And that's difficult for a lot of people on the autism spectrum, understanding the social rules and understanding other people's intentions, understanding other people's emotions. There is a myth, though, that I'd like to dispel right away, and that is that people with autism don't have emotions or don't have empathy. I think it's more of a problem in understanding other people's perspectives. It's not that you can't feel empathy for other people. It's not that you can't feel sad or feel happy. It may be a problem in expressing feeling sad or feeling happy in the way that we all do. So that's the second issue, a problem in social understanding. And then a very common related issue is sensory issues. And that has to do with sensitivities to our sensory world, which could include the sounds in the world, what we see through vision, the way we process touch when people touch us. There are many aspects to sensory processing, but we as human beings are always trying to take that sensory information, be able to cope with it, deal with it, and process it. And we know that people on the spectrum may be overly sensitive, where sounds may be painful or too loud, or undersensitive, where they may not be able to register or take in that information. So right now, those are the areas that are focused on when we talk about the definition of autism.
Very interesting. Can you share with us your first encounter with a person on the spectrum?
Well, I let me break this into two categories. My first encounters before I knew or even heard the word autism definitely goes back to my public school experiences. I remember in fourth, fifth, sixth grade, there were classes, and it's the New York City public school. There were what's called segregated classes for children with disabilities of various types. And I remember being very interested in those kids and volunteering in those classes sometimes and helping out. And I'm sure that there were some kids who would have met a diagnosis of autism in those classes back then. But in terms of my actual work where I heard the label and was beginning to hear, understand the label of autism, that happened in summer camps, as I mentioned, starting when I was about 18 years of age, when I was living with people, and both children and adults with various disabilities, including those with autism.
That experience in itself had sort of contributed to your vocation. How has that over the years evolved to the person you are today?
It's had a tremendous impact because I believe when I had the opportunity to live on a daily basis, to be responsible for the welfare of children and autistic adults as well, it was a very, very, if you will, influential aspect of me understanding, well, this is what it's like. You know, this is what a parent must feel like when they turn around and they can't find their child and they feel that feeling of panic when they're in a public park and all of a sudden their child has bolted away from them, or explaining the behavior of the children at the camp to other people, like when we would go out to see a rodeo or we would go to an amusement park. So I had some of that experience, even though in no way is it like the 24/7 experience of being a parent. But it enabled me to see that side of life with autism, if you will. And then that had a great influence on when I began to study people and working with people with disabilities from an academic perspective, because I had that real-life experience first rather than the book-learning experience first.
Very interesting.
And I should say one other thing. I fell in love with these kids and these people. I mean, I just very, very interesting, engaging people. At times, of course, there were great difficulties and challenges, but I was hooked. I was hooked from very early on, and I kind of knew this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
You apparently saw something special, something that perhaps the rest of us don't see, the uniqueness in this individual. Why do we need to have a better understanding about autism?
That's a large reason why I wrote the book. Even the title, Uniquely Human, tries to help the reader understand that much of what we hear in the media, much of what we hear over the years, are myths or misconceptions about autism. And I want to put right up front, this is not about sugarcoating autism, because for many parents, and in some cases, it's a very difficult, even agonizing experience, especially for those autistic people who are much, much more challenged and have a lot of biomedical issues associated with their autism. But I think, you know, this myth of the autistic child or the person with autism being isolated, not interested in people, lacking empathy, as I mentioned, being kind of apart from humanity, that is something that I really try to challenge in the book. And let's talk about the behavior of children with autism and people with autism as human behavior that we can relate to. Sometimes we can't understand it. Sometimes if a person can't communicate what they're observing or feeling, you know, it's difficult for many of us who don't have kids to understand what that's about. So basically, we have to have a better understanding, because we really have to change public perception about the experience of autism for the family and for the individual.
So true. Your book talks about listening builds trust. Please elaborate on that.
This is actually, I can expand on what I just said here, that what I mean by listening is, well, it certainly has to do with listening to what a person is saying, but it also has to do with carefully watching and really asking the question why, because many people, children who have autism, do things that may not be so understandable to us. So, for example, an autistic child may insist on sitting at the same seat at lunch all the time and may get very, very upset if he or she can't do that. Now, for that child, it might be because it's very predictable. This makes me feel more grounded. It makes me feel better if I keep things the same. And that's one of the characteristics of autism. You know, that what has been called the need to have things very consistent, predictable. Actually, the phrase that was used in the first discussion of autism in 1943 was insistence on sameness. Well, we all benefit from sameness. We all benefit from routines. We all benefit from things being very predictable in our lives. We all benefit from having the same schedule every day. But there's a heightened need for that for people with autism. So getting back to the listening building trust, rather than just labeling what a person with autism does as pathological or deviant, which has been done for many, many years in the literature, let's say, you know, what happens if we really watch and we see what the person is doing and we keep asking that question, well, why does this child insist on standing on line at the front of the line in school in his class? Or why does this child always insist on having peanut butter and jelly sandwiches at lunch? Or why does this child rock? Or why does this child flap when he gets excited? So the point is that the more we get to know a person, it builds trust, because that person then comes to see that we get them, that that we're not just judging and trying to change them, that we're trying to understand them.
I love the approach of asking why, because rather than presuming that a person did something for whatever reason, I always like to ask, why did you do this? Can you explain to me why you did this? And then what happens is that I'm educating myself, and that's part of incorporating your concept of the art of listening. Once you have a better understanding of the actions, then you can react appropriately.
Yes, and when it comes to getting answers to the why question, yeah, we are in a very different place than we were, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. Because there
That's
are
correct.
So many autistic adults now who are telling us why. Mm-hmm. They explain what their life is like. One sad thing that has happened, because I'm in touch with a lot of autistic adults,
sure,
and by the way, I've gotten wonderful reactions to my book, which is just so personally validating, you know, for me,
mm-hmm,
that autistic adults are saying, you know, thank you for the book, Barry. It's really helping us, or helping people to understand us. But one of the sad things is that very, very articulate, bright, very bright people who are on the autism spectrum feel they're not listened to. They
mm-hmm
feel that, because there are many books written by autistic people. There are many presentations given by autistic people. And by the way, I use the term autistic people because many adults with autism prefer to be called autistic rather than person with autism, because they say
mm-hmm
it's an inseparable part of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I learn so much every day by reading blogs written by autistic adults and hearing how they react to my book. So that's
mm-hmm
been very helpful for me. And we should continue to listen to them.
Very interesting. When you mentioned about the familiarity situation, it reminded me of, on the lighter side of things, I love the show The Big Bang Theory on
yeah,
TV.
Yes, sure.
I don't know whether you've seen that.
Oh, yes, many times.
Right, and it reminded me of the character Sheldon Cooper, who is, in all practical purposes, a genius. When you mentioned the tendency of the conformity of, I have to have it this way, I have to have it that way, those are things that, well, in this case, I would guess, would be behavior of an autistic person in some ways, the comfort zone, so to speak.
Exactly. And you know, when Sheldon always wants to sit in the same corner in the couch.
Right.
I mean, it's funny when we look at it from the outside, but
right,
what I try to point out in many ways in the book is that really so different than the rest of us?
Right.
I
right
mean, we may get upset if somebody sits in our favorite chair after a hard day of work.
Right.
However, it seems to be just more common and a little bit more inflexible in those people who have the label of autism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So true. I like the way you use the concept of enthusiastic in your book. How does the enthusiastic behavior of an autistic child contribute to better communication and connection?
Yeah, and then by enthusiastic, the actual chapter in the book is what I call enthusiasms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a phrase that I learned from a mother, actually a leader in the field of autism who passed away a few years ago, Clara Claiborne Park. What it refers to is, what is this child or this person passionate about? What do they love to do? What really rivets their attention? What do they put a lot of energy into? And it's a wonderful example of how things have changed over the years in understanding autistic people, that what we used to call obsessions and what some people still call
mm-hmm
obsessions and obsessive behavior is now referred to by some autistic adults as deep interests and their passions. So this is huge, because it's not just increasing our understanding, but it gives us a window into the way a person may see the world, but it also gives us a window into relationship and connections
mm-hmm
and communication. I recently spoke over the summer at the Autism Society of America conference, and I was talking about this topic, and a young man with a diagnosis of autism in the audience stood up and he said, "When you relate to me through my interests, it opens doors for me." And he said, "I am much, much more willing to, you know, work at the difficult task of communicating with a stranger and talking with you. And I want to be with you because you're interested in what I'm interested in." Now, yeah. Again, is that so different than the rest of us? When we start talking with strangers, what do? We look for common interests. Oh, do you like to go skiing? Oh, I like to go skiing. Oh, yeah, I go to Colorado every winter. And by the way, I'm not a skier, but we always look for commonalities when we connect with other people. It seems to be that much more important to connect with people with autism. And now they're telling us that. If you're interested in what I'm interested in, it goes a long way in me feeling comfortable with you and feeling connected to you. And one other point on this, it could be used so creatively. Some of my greatest successes in consulting to schools where students were having difficulty, they weren't succeeding, they were shutting down, they were feeling depressed in school, had to do with helping the school staff connect to what they were interested in. So, for example, one student loved cooking at home, and in his middle school program, there were no opportunities for that. So we made some opportunities for him to work with some other students in cooking activities. So it not only increased social skills, but he felt more connected to the school and to other kids.
Very interesting. At some point, you mentioned about enthusiasm becoming an issue. Tell us about that.
Yes. Sometimes an autistic person or a student with autism might become a little bit overly, if you will, immersed in something that they're very interested or passionate about. And if that prevents or inhibits engagement with other people, for example, a student who only wants to play video games all the time, certainly we have to create boundaries. Or I like to refer to it as teaching, there's a time and a place. So yes, you could do what you're thoroughly passionate about, but it doesn't mean you can do it all the time. And then sometimes there are enthusiasms that may lead to less desirable behavior, even though the intention is not bad. So let me give you an example. I knew a young man, a tall, handsome 18-year-old young man who had a diagnosis of autism. And for some reason, he became very interested in women's ankles. And whenever he would, for example, be out in public or in the mall, and he would see a woman wearing shoes where the ankles were exposed, he would want to get down and look at those ankles. And, of course, that's not only socially less desirable or undesirable, but that's scary to other people.
Right.
So in rare instances, a person with autism may be very highly focused on something that leads to behavior, which maybe is not the best situation in the world. And then it has to do with learning social skills and
right.
helping on our part. That person learned that, well, there are some things you can do. There are some things that we expect that you will do as a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old, but there are other things that are not expected, and other people won't understand that, so we really can't do those things.
Yeah.
I should add, because I haven't mentioned it yet, there's a full range of ability in autism. You know, so there are individuals, as I mentioned, who are very, very verbal, bright, academically, and extremely intelligent. And there are some people who are autistic who you could speak with them for quite a while and not even see anything that appears to be
right.
that different, all the way down to individuals whose behavior is much less kind of socially conventional, and their communication might be much more limited.
Can that be attributed to the fact that one has greater therapy than the other in some ways?
I think certainly the impact of treatment and therapy is one of the factors, but I think it also gets back to a person's neurology, that we know that there are neurological differences and brain processing differences in people with autism. And I think some people are impacted much more greatly than others on a neurological level. And we see that in other ways, that, you know, about, I believe the number is about 15% of people with autism have seizure disorders as well.
Right.
So there are other signs of neurological involvement in different subgroups of people with autism. So there are many factors that may contribute to how a person is doing, how much progress they make, how well they're able to communicate. Mm-hmm. One of those factors certainly is treatment, and there's a lot of research going on in this area now.
Interesting. You talk about trust, fear in your book as well. If we want to consider ourselves as the average people or whatnot, trust and fear also affects us. How do trust and fear affect a person on the spectrum?
And the way I think about this is through three different categories or types of trust. Mm-hmm. And again, we can relate to all of this ourselves, but first of all, we need to be able to trust people. Are people dependable? Do they follow through on what they say? For example, you may know a person who their mood and their emotional expression shifts very dramatically. That mm-hmm. sometimes they're really nice to you and they're very kind with you, and then other times they stress you out. And people who are less trustworthy are those who are more difficult to read and who end up being kind of less dependable in the sense that I can predict how this person will be. You know, they're kind of steady, they're well-grounded. Autistic people and children on the spectrum have a real difficult time, first of all, reading people. But then if you have people who are very undependable and shift dramatically in how they react and behave and express themselves, that's mm-hmm. very difficult. The second type of trust is trust in your own body and trust in your own physical being. And if you've ever had a serious illness, anybody who's ever had a serious illness can relate to this, because you begin to say, I can't trust my body. Why am I getting these migraine headaches? Mm-hmm. Why is it difficult at times for my stomach to digest certain foods? The more we feel grounded, the healthier we are as people, the more mm-hmm. we could trust our own body, because in a sense, our body doesn't do things to us that's a surprise, or that's painful, or that's difficult to deal with. Now, what does this have to do with autism? We do know that there are associated medical conditions that people with autism very often experience. So, for example, gastrointestinal issues, it's estimated about 40% of people with a diagnosis of autism have mild to severe gastrointestinal issues. I mentioned seizure disorder and also sensory sensitivities, where sounds may sound too loud or touch may feel painful. So that's the second area, and that has to do with one's physical being. The final area of trust is trust in the world. Are things consistent and predictable? Is the school schedule always followed the same way, or are there drastic changes? So, for example, if there's a fire drill, that's extremely difficult for many students who have a diagnosis on the spectrum, because it's not only do you hear a loud noise, but all of a sudden everything changes rapidly, that everybody has to stop talking, and then you have to get online. And if you think of what happens in a fire drill, in a sense it's a violation of trust, because we don't expect that to happen during the school day. Yet we need to do it to prepare for these unexpected events, emergencies such as fires. So all of these things have a huge role in how we develop trust in life. We trust other people. We trust our own body. We trust the world and how the world works. For people on the spectrum, it's that much more difficult. And it results in a high degree of anxiety and fear in some cases. So a lot of what we do in education, a lot of what we do in therapies is to help people with autism develop trust in other people, develop trust in their own body, for example, being able to tell us if something hurts rather than being overwhelmed by that, and developing trust in the world.
What I gather from the book and from what you just said is that basically we're all the same. What happens here is that it's just simply magnified for people on the spectrum.
Exactly, Johnny. And as a matter of fact, one of my favorite ways to describe, from my perspective, the experience of autism is that autistic people, children with autism, have difficulties with the same kind of things that we have difficulties with, except they're more vulnerable and they do not naturally develop the coping skills that we develop. You know, if we're getting a cold and we're congested, a coping skill is we say to ourselves, oh, this is a cold. Well, I know I have a cold now. I know what I could do, and it'll probably be over in 5 to 7 days. A person on the spectrum who gets a cold, especially those with fewer communication abilities who can't ask about that or can't understand what that's about, may think, what's happening to my body now? I got this headache and my head's all congested. Mm-hmm. They don't have the coping skills or the understanding. We can ask to leave a situation like a very loud party or if we're in a very noisy situation. We might say, I don't want to stay here, where a young child with autism may melt down and drop to the floor and start screaming. So we have far more coping skills to deal with some of the similar challenges that people who have a diagnosis with autism face every day. But we all face those challenges in life.
Very interesting. One of the ways I like you talk about in terms of coping skills and so forth is sharing control with a person on the spectrum. How does that help to develop that person?
Yes. Well, if we think about it, when we have control in our lives, we're much better able to cope. When somebody is trying to control us or is imposing their will on us, that causes a lot of stress. So one of the things that we emphasize and other people emphasize in good treatment approaches is to give autistic people more choices. And it doesn't mean open-ended. It doesn't mean, what do you want to do now? Because that can be very stressful. But offering choices as to what do you want to do on your schedule now? Or would you like to stay longer or do you want to leave? Let's say you're visiting a friend or an amusement park. Control also supports communication. That if you know that you can request what you want of another person, that makes you feel more grounded. And it also helps the other person, because that other person doesn't always have to guess whether you're hungry or whether you need to take a nap or whether you want to leave that noisy situation. So shared control is understanding that the more we give choices and the more we help a person make decisions in their life, the more, and this is an important term now, the more self-determined they will be. Because we want any person who has a developmental disability or any person in life to be able to make good decisions and feel that sense of control in their lives. So it's a big focus.
So true. One of the topics that I really like in the book, you talk about emotional memory. This is something that we all go through in our life and we experience ourselves about emotional memory.
Yes.
What is emotional memory and how can we help to develop a better emotional memory?
When we think about memory, so often we think about factual memory. The fancy word for that is propositional memory. And that is, we think of the facts. So for example, how many miles away does my friend live? Or how long will it take for me to get there? And, he lives in a large house that he just built and so forth. Emotional memory has to do with the feelings that we associate with a person, a place, or an activity. So giving that same example, the emotional memory of going to visit my friend in his new house might be, I really love to see him. It makes me feel so good when I'm there. Or, I really don't like that house so much. I don't like the way he designed it. So you can have positive or negative emotional memories about people, about places, or about activities or experiences. So the way we see this as so important in understanding the reactions of people with autism is that one of the things we do know, and this is supported by research, is that people with autism have a relatively good memory, in some cases an exceptional memory, for people, places, events, and facts. If they have many stressful memories, that may lead to a child or a person avoiding certain people or refusing to go to certain places. So emotional memory tells us a little bit about the why. Why is this person acting that way? And because of the disability of autism, most autistic people have more stress in their lives than the rest of us have. Due to the lack of trust, as we mentioned, due to the fear they may experience. So we try to build in as many positive emotional memories as possible as it relates to people. And we could be a positive emotional memory if we are dependable, if we honor a person's passions and interests, a place. Is this place tolerable? For example, Movie theaters these days are often extremely loud, and kids and people with autism could not tolerate that amount of noise. So now many movie theaters are doing what's called sensory-friendly showing of films. Sensory-friendly meaning it's not going to overwhelm you. We're going to put the volume down much, much lower so you could tolerate that. So people with autism could have more positive memories about going to the movies. And by the way, it's not just an autism thing. As I've gotten
right.
older, I can't tolerate the level of sound in most movie theaters. And sometimes I just won't go, or sometimes I'll leave because it's too loud, and because that's a negative emotional memory. So the whole point is we want people with autism to develop positive memories about being with people, about going to a lot of different places, and engaging in activities or events. So they will be more motivated and less stressed in doing so.
What we have talked about are all social rules and social interaction. What are some of the challenges of learning social rules?
Well, social rules, many social rules, are what we refer to as invisible rules.
Mm-hmm.
That rules having to do with the ways we should behave, and sometimes we're not taught those explicitly. So as I mentioned earlier, there are social rules in how you behave in a cafeteria. Can you cut into line if you want to skip the hot food section and go to the cold food section? Where do you pay? And so forth. Social rules, by the nature of the neurologically based disability of autism, are very difficult for people with autism to figure out. And one of the major reasons here is that rules change from one situation to another situation. So, for example, it's okay to use or speak in a loud voice out on the playground, but in a library, it's not okay. Now, if you don't have autism, you might walk into a library and notice that everybody's either not speaking or whispering, and right away you say, oh, well, if that's the way they're behaving, that's the way I should behave. It's very difficult for autistic people to look at the social landscape and figure out what the social rules are. So sometimes we have to explicitly teach those social rules. One of the things that I find fascinating is sometimes when autistic people violate those social rules, if you look at it a different way, they're really being very, very honest. So I met a young man who was working in a drugstore, a man in his 20s, who had a diagnosis of autism. And he told me that his supervisor was very angry at him. And I said, why? And he said, well, a woman came in to the drugstore looking to buy batteries. But I told her if she went to the hardware store down the block, she can get the same batteries much cheaper. Okay? In other words, he was being totally honest.
Right,
and he was told
right.
we have to be kind to our customers. So
right.
sometimes it's being too honest, if you will.
Right. Right.
And, but what's the unwritten social rule? If you work in a store, you want the people to buy the things in your store.
Right.
Okay. So there are many, many social rules that we are guided by every day. And by the way, the best way to know how complicated social rules can be, even for us, is to step into a different country, especially if you live in a Western country, into a non-Western country where rules of eye contact are very different. Rules of touching each other are very different. So social rules are very, very much culturally determined as well.
Right. So true. I read that story. I love it. I thought it was like, okay, is it right or wrong when you think about it? Because you are taking care of the customers. And you're there being honest in terms of, hey, if you want to buy this, we have the best deal in town.
Right, exactly. Well, if you think of it, we really engage in a lot of deception in our culture. And for various reasons. You know, we tell little white lies. We give misinformation if it benefits us or it benefits our business. We do that all the time. The one thing I find so interesting, and if you will, I really respect this about people with autism, is they don't understand that. They don't understand why a person would not tell the truth all the time or deceive other
Precisely.
People. So.
What I gather is the fact that they are extremely genuine.
That's a great word. Very genuine, yes.
Yeah. Are there limits to teaching social rules?
Well, there are limits to the extent that some social rules are very, very complex, but especially because they change all the time. So very often you have to teach a social rule, but then you have to teach kind of the violation to that rule. So we may teach a person to comment very positively about a haircut that somebody had and say, oh, I like the way your hair looks. You just got a haircut.
Right.
But a month later, it might be, you know, I see you got a haircut, but I like the way your hair looked last month better. That was a much better haircut. Another person would take that as an insult, yet we've taught that person to comment on somebody else's appearance. An example I give in the book is a student who is in kind of a health class in school, and they're learning about different body types, and that some people are skinny and some people are fat or heavy and other people are tall. That evening, that student went with his parents to see a movie, and there was a long line in front of the movie, and he was kind of bored, so he decided to practice his lesson. And he went up and down the line in the movie theater saying, and here is a fat man, and here is a skinny man, and here's a man who's very, very tall. Another quick example that we give in the book is a young man who was very talented in piano, and he was asked, would he play piano at a nursing home? And he didn't know much about nursing homes, and he was told that there are very, very old people there and often very sick, and they might die soon. And just he went there, and before he started playing piano, he said, I'm very happy to be here to play piano for you, but I'm so sorry that many of you will die soon. And he was just saying what was told to him, so he understood where he was going and who he was entertaining. So those are problems with social rules.
I read that story, so I thought it was really funny and interesting. It reminded me of one of my students, actually. She is in her late 60s, I would say, and I say that respectfully, she might be even older than that. She has a grandchild. You know how kids are. I mean, you can tell them, and they take things literally. And so when you talk about age, she has a license plate that stop growing above and beyond 39 years old. So I was telling her that somewhere along the line, you need to understand now, this little girl, this little granddaughter of yours, once she gets to the age where she can start counting, she's going to say, Grandma, I think you're wrong. Last year you were 39, and this year you got to be 40.
Right. Yeah. And you make an interesting point that certainly people with autism have difficulty understanding the social rules, but there's also a developmental piece to this, that sometimes we see the behavior of people with autism where it looks like it's a much younger child, because young kids are learning those social rules as well.
Right. Very interesting. Can emotions be taught to a person on the spectrum?
I think the starting point for this question is, again, the old myth that people with autism, autistic children, did not have emotions. I mean, literally, 40, 50 years ago, they were thought of, or even 30 years ago, some people thought of a person with autism as being an empty shell, not having humanity, not experiencing emotions. As a matter of fact, we now believe that people on the spectrum experiencing emotions very intensively. And the answer is yes, that they can be taught emotions, and there are different aspects of that. One is emotional recognition, recognizing other people's emotions and other people's feelings. So even, you know, Sheldon Cooper on Big Bang Theory has problems with that, okay? And then there's emotional expression, being able to express yourself in a way that communicates that very complex, abstract notion of emotion. Because emotion words, by the way, and as I mentioned, I'm a speech-language pathologist, and we talk about, well, what about these language concepts? Emotion language concepts are some of the most abstract and difficult concepts to understand, such as frustration or feeling embarrassed or feeling angry or feeling elated. These words do not have something concrete to refer to, like a cup or a pencil. And because they're so abstract, and because of the disability of autism, we have to work really, really hard and support people in understanding how other people express emotions, but also how they can express their emotions and feelings to us. But when you really do work hard on this, and you talk about emotions every day in everyday life, I know people on the spectrum who are very good at expressing exactly how they feel, but it's a long, hard road to get there for some autistic people.
Very interesting. What should we focus on then when trying to understand and basically be in the mode of getting it with a person on the spectrum?
Yeah. In my book, Uniquely Human, I talk about those people who get it very naturally. In other words, they know how to relate to and support a person with autism. And those people who are not so good but have good intentions are the it-like people. Those are the people that we really have to support. And I also mentioned a third category, the it-less people. And those people just tend to stress out people with autism much more. And by the way, I didn't invent that. I learned that from a mother a number of years ago in British Columbia who was talking about her son. So what do we focus on? Some of the things I've already mentioned. First of all, what is this person interested in? What are their strengths? What can we go with that enables us to develop that trusting relationship with them? Also, something else we mentioned is really paying attention to the person. In some approaches in the field of autism, there are programs written that if a child screams, you should do this. You should ignore the child, or you should say, stop screaming. And if we follow a program, it doesn't allow us to really listen carefully, pay attention to the person, and connect with that person. So that's another characteristic of people who get it, that they really relate to the person and listen to that person and pay attention carefully. Something else we mentioned is that shared control notion. Some people just try to control autistic people or control students with autism. And we look at we feel it's important to support that person, to be, and this is the first time I'm using this term, it's a very important concept, to help that person be well-regulated emotionally and not feel stressed out and not feel fear so much of the time that a lot of autistic people feel. So how can we be supportive in the way we communicate, in the way we interact, in the way we offer choices? And another very important point, and there are so many more, but I'll end with this point for now, is understanding that person within the context of their family and their life, that we just don't look at the person and say, well, I want to change this person to behave this way. Well, what about the family? What is mother and father or the parents, or what are their priorities for their child or their family member with autism? Because so often we do not use the information from people who know that person the best. And in our approach, we use a very, what's called a family-centered approach, that we always look at a person, look at a child within the context of their culture and within the context of their family, not just isolate them and put them under a microscope.
That's a wonderful approach. By the way, Dr. Barry, you are talking about the model that you and your fellow colleagues have put together. It's called CERT. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. We've developed an educational model that's now being used in more than a dozen countries and across the United States. It's called the CERTS model, which stands for social communication, and we've spoken already about how important communication is, emotional regulation, and we've spoken about that as well, helping a person, you know, not feel fearful much of the time and feel comfortable in developing trust. And then the TS refers to transactional support, which means all the ways that we support an autistic person, a child with autism, and their family. And if people are interested in more information about that, they can go to my website, which is simply my name, barryprezant.com. And also we have a website on the CERTS model, which is www.scerts.com. And we do trainings nationally and internationally all the time on this approach. And it's gotten some very, very good research to support how effective it is.
Fantastic. What advice do you have for parents who has a child that has just been diagnosed as a child on the spectrum?
I think, you know, the very first thing that I say to a parent is that your child, there's so much opportunity for growth and so much potential in your child. You cannot look at a young child and predict where he or she will be years later. That's, if you will, that's one of the shortcomings of research. We just can't do that. There are kids who are late bloomers. There are kids who start speaking much later. Yet too often parents are told all the things their child can't do or all the things their child may never be able to do. Now, that's changed over the last few years. But still, it's so important for parents to realize that the growth that their child can make and their potential is virtually unlimited. I always tell parents also to connect with other parents who are a little bit further down the path on their journey. What I've learned from our parent retreat is parents can be the best supports for other parents because they've walked in the same shoes and they've had, in many cases, some of the same experiences. I also like to emphasize that there's so much misinformation that's out there, especially on the internet, about autism spectrum disorders, about different kinds of treatments. So I always tell parents to be very, very critical and very skeptical. And does very important point here, does this make sense for my child? A lot of times parents are told to do things that don't make sense for their child, but they believe the experts have all the answers. And in a sense, it asks them to violate, you know, their gut reaction and their gut feeling about their child. So I tell them to trust their gut, that they know their child the best. Certainly, professionals are very important people to help parents along the journey, but they know their child the best. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of other things very quickly. Listen to people who have that diagnosis of autism. There are so many experts out there who've lived very long lives now, people in their 30s and 40s who talk about, this is what my autism means to me, this is what has helped me, these are the kinds of people who've helped me. So listening to people who have that diagnosis of autism, very important. And finally, take care of yourself. So many parents, out of their desire and their great love for their children, do so much, like staying up till 3 in the morning every night, looking on the internet for the next best treatment. Or just not giving up their exercise regimen, for example, just not doing the types of things that they know is important for their own health. Because the more they take care of themselves, the healthier they are emotionally and physically, the more energy they have to support their child. And that's very, very important.
This is a very touchy topic. When is the best time to tell a child he or she has autism?
I wish we knew some more about this, but here's my opinion. For some children, for those children who speak, who begin to say, well, why am I different?
Right.
I knew a child who first began to say, you know, when I get angry, I have problems controlling my body. Am I crazy? The child actually asked that question.
Mm-hmm.
When
mm-hmm.
kids begin to notice differences or ask questions, differences between themselves and other kids, especially for those kids who are fully or partially included with other kids in the school, which is the majority of kids with autism now. So what we're talking about is called disclosure, and it's not just, well, you tell your child he or she has a diagnosis of autism, but you present the balanced view. Well, what are the good things about having autism? Well, what are the things that are not so good? What about famous people who probably were on the autism spectrum, such as an Einstein or now a Temple Grandin who's a professor of animal science? So it's not just when do you tell, it's also how do you tell? Some people would say even if a child's not speaking yet, you should begin to talk about autism. Or, hey, you know, you did that really well because you have autism and that helps you really draw things really well. Or you can remember things really well. As opposed to, you know, sometimes you get confused about other children or you misunderstand what other children are saying, and that maybe is due to your autism. So let me just finish this my answer by saying it's very important that at some point parents and sometimes as a team, professionals as well, talk with a child or a person about their autism and help them understand it. Very, very important.
So true. What role should siblings play in the life of a child with autism?
Well, siblings can play many roles, can be a teacher, can be a best friend. The one thing we do know is that we don't want to give the message to siblings that they should be another parent. There's a term for that, the parentified child. That's asking a sibling to be doing too much, which may not be appropriate to their age. And it may also make them feel like this is being imposed upon them. Also, we don't want to give a message to children who are siblings that, well, you don't have to worry about your brother and sister. Mom and dad or a parent will take care of everything. So the middle ground, research has actually demonstrated that the middle ground's the best, that a brother or sister should be asked to be helpful, to help out with some things, maybe, you know, spend time with their brother and sister to help them play, maybe get some of their friends involved with their brother and sister, but we shouldn't ask them to do too much, and we shouldn't ask them to do nothing at all or too little. They should feel good about the role they're playing with their brother or sister.
Very interesting. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading your number one book, Uniquely Human?
First of all, that autistic people, children with autism, are interesting and engaging people. And you could learn as much from them as they learn from us. It really does add to your life. Number two, we really try to get across in Uniquely Human what is life like from the perspective of an autistic person. And in that book, I have a whole chapter about people who have that diagnosis and what life has been like for them and what we can learn from what they are doing in their lives right now. And I guess finally, the last major point is also understanding the family experience, that autism is not simply a tragedy. Many families say they grow in immeasurable ways, that they love their son and daughter with autism, and that they learn from their autistic child or the family member with autism every day. So this notion of autism is simply a tragedy for the person who has that diagnosis and the family is a false notion. And we really try to get across that very clearly in the book without sugarcoating autism, because autism can be very debilitating and challenging in some situations. But in other situations, parents just say, you know, my son John is just like a member of the family like the rest of us, and we've always treated him that way, and we don't see autism as a tragedy at all.
So true. I love the book. I know it's designed for caregivers and parents and so forth, but I believe
and professionals,
that this, and professionals, and yes. But I do believe that this book should be read by everyone so that you have a better understanding about all of us as human beings.
Yes, I hope so as well. Thank you.
Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you and your programs and events?
The first place they can go is my website, www.barryprizant, that's BarryPrizant.com. Regarding the book, they can go to Simon & Schuster, the website, and just put in Uniquely Human. And you will see on both of those sites many, many reviews. And on my website, they can also get links to information about the CERTS model and many other topics that we've written about in the field of autism and disabilities in children.
Fantastic. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Yeah, a few quick points. First of all, I like to live life one step at a time and not worry about things that may never happen. And that's, I think, a very, very important issue for me, also for families who have family members with autism. Secondly, the importance of finding in your life's work what you love and what fulfills you. And I strongly encourage people to go into fields of helping people and families who need that help, whether it's childhood disabilities, medical fields, or whatever. But I've had such an enriched life. I'm 64 years of age now, and my life has been fantastic because I have found in my life's work what I love to do. And then finally, surround yourself with positive energy, with people who really think positively. And as one dad told me about his experience of having a son with autism, avoid the doom and gloom crowd. Stay around people who think positively.
That's fantastic. Dr. Prezant, thank you for the wonderful recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Marie Jagopoulos. She is an intuitive counselor, healer, and spiritual mentor. Marie will be hosting and conducting her biweekly Meditation for Moms series and talk about her worldwide consciousness movement, Meditation for Mom. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Dr. Prezant, it's been a true pleasure. Thank you so much for your wonderful recipe for living. You're a highly evolved person. Have a blessed day, sir.
Great. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.